And another time, as we emerged onto a turn of the highway, my two little sisters, in their wild curiosity, almost fell out of the Red Family torpedo swerving toward the bridge. On dark, rainy evenings, I would load the lamp of my bicycle with magical lumps of calcium carbide, shield a match from the gusty wind, and having imprisoned a white flame in the glass, ride cautiously into the darkness. The circle of light cast by my lamp would pick out the damp, smooth shoulder of the road, between its central system of puddles and the long bordering grasses. Like a tottering ghost, the pale ray would weave across a clay bank at the turn as I began the downhill ride toward the river. Beyond the bridge, the road sloped up again to meet the Rojestvieno-Luga Highway, and just above that junction, a footpath among dripping jasmine bushes ascended a steep escarpment. I had to dismount and push my bicycle. As I reached the top, my livid light flitted across the six-pillared white portico at the back of my uncle's mute, shuttered manor, as mute and shuttered as it may be today, half a century later. There, in a corner of that arched shelter from where she had been following the zigzags of my ascending light, Tamara would be waiting, perched on the broad parapet with her back to a pillar. I would put out my lamp and grope my way toward her. One is moved to speak more eloquently about these things, about many other things that one always hopes might survive captivity in the zoo of words, but the ancient limes crowding close to the house drown Mnemosyne's monologue with their creaking and heaving in the restless night. Their sigh would subside. The rainpipe at one side of the porch, a small busybody of water, could be heard steadily bubbling. At times, some additional rustle, troubling the rhythm of the rain in the leaves, would cause Tamara to turn her head in the direction of an imagined footfall, and then, by a faint luminosity, now rising above the horizon of my memory despite all that rain, I could distinguish the outline of her face. But there was nothing and nobody to fear, and presently she would gently exhale the breath she had held for a moment, and her eyes would close again. 2. With the coming of winter, our reckless romance was transplanted to grim St. Petersburg. We found ourselves horribly deprived of the sylvan security we had grown accustomed to. Hotels disreputable enough to admit us stood beyond the limits of our daring, and the great era of Parc d'Amours was still remote. The secrecy that had been so pleasurable in the country now became a burden, yet neither of us could face the notion of chaperoned meetings at her home or mine. Consequently, we were forced to wander a good deal about the town, she in her little gray furred coat, I white-spatted and caracal-collared, with a knuckle-duster in my velvet-lined pocket. And this permanent quest for some kind of refuge produced an odd sense of hopelessness, which in its turn foreshadowed other, much later and lonelier, roamings. We skipped school. I forget what Tamara's procedure was. Mine consisted of talking either of the two chauffeurs into dropping me at this or that corner on the way to school. Both were good sports and actually refused to accept my gold, handy five-ruble pieces coming from the bank in appetizing, weighty sausages of 10 or 20 shining pieces, in the aesthetic recollection of which I can freely indulge now that my proud émigré destitution is also a thing of the past. Nor had I any trouble with our wonderful, eminently bribable Ustin, who took the calls on our ground-floor telephone, the number of which was 2443. He briskly replied I had a sore throat. I wonder, by the way, what would happen if I put in a long-distance call from my desk right now. No answer. No such number, no such country. Or the voice of Ustin, saying, «Moyo pochtenietze», the ingratiating diminutive of my respects. There exist, after all, well-publicized Slavs and Kurds who are well over 150. My father's telephone in his study, 58451, was not listed, and my form master, in his attempts to learn the truth about my failing health, never got anywhere, though sometimes I missed 3 days in a row. We walked under the white lacery of berimed avenues in public parks. We huddled together on cold benches, after having removed first their tidy cover of snow, then our snow-encrusted mittens. We haunted museums. They were drowsy and deserted on weekday mornings, and very warm, in contrast to the glacial haze and its red sun that, like a flushed moon, hung in the eastern windows. There we would seek the quiet back rooms, the stopgap mythologies nobody looked at, the etchings, the medals, the paleographic items, the story of printing, poor things like that. Our best find, I think, was a small room where brooms and ladders were kept, but a batch of empty frames that suddenly started to slide and topple in the dark attracted an inquisitive art lover, and we fled. The Hermitage, St. Petersburg's Louvre, offered nice nooks, especially in a certain hall on the ground floor among cabinets with scarabs, behind the sarcophagus of Nana, High Priest of Ptah, in the Russian Museum of Emperor Alexander III, two halls, numbers 30 and 31, in its northeastern corner, harboring repellently academic paintings by Shishkin, clearing in a pine forest, and by Harlamov, head of a young gypsy, offered a bit of privacy because of some tall stands with drawings, until a foul-mouthed veteran of the Turkish campaign threatened to call the police. So from these great museums, we graduated to smaller ones, such as the Suvorov, for instance, where I recall a most silent room full of old armor and tapestries and torn silk banners, with several bewigged, heavily booted dummies in green uniforms standing guard over us. But wherever we went, invariably after a few visits, this or that hoary, bleary-eyed, felt-soled attendant would grow suspicious, and we would have to transfer our furtive frenzy elsewhere, to the Pedagogical Museum, to the Museum of Court Carriages, or to a tiny museum of old maps, which guidebooks do not even list, and then out again into the cold, into some lane of great gates and green lions with rings in their jaws, into the stylized snowscape of the art world, Mir Iskustva, Dobuzhinsky, Alexander Benoit, so dear to me in those days. On late afternoons, we got into the last row of seats in one of the two movie theaters, the Parisiana and the Piccadilly on Nevsky Avenue. The art was progressing. Sea waves were tinted a sickly blue, and as they rode in and burst into foam against a black, remembered rock, Rocher de la Vierge, Biarritz, funny, I thought, to see again the beach of my cosmopolitan childhood, there was a special machine that imitated the sound of the surf, making a kind of washy swish that never quite managed to stop short with the scene, but for 3 or 4 seconds accompanied the next feature, a brisk funeral, say, or shabby prisoners of war with their dapper captors. As often as not, the title of the main picture was a quotation from some popular poem or song, and might be quite long-winded, such as "The chrysanthemums blossom no more in the garden," or "Her heart was a toy in his hands, and like a toy it got broken." Female stars had low foreheads, magnificent eyebrows, lavishly shaded eyes. The favorite actor of the day was Mozhugin. One famous director had acquired in the Moscow countryside a white-pillared mansion, not unlike that of my uncle, and it appeared in all the pictures he made. Mozhugin would drive up to it in a smart sleigh and fix a steely eye on a light in one window, while a celebrated little muscle twitched under the tight skin of his jaw. When museums and movie houses failed us and the night was young, we were reduced to exploring the wilderness of the world's most gaunt and enigmatic city. Solitary street lamps were metamorphosed into sea creatures with prismatic spines by the icy moisture on our eyelashes. As we crossed the vast squares, various architectural phantoms arose with silent suddenness right before us. We felt a cold chill, generally associated not with height but with depth, with an abyss opening at one's feet, when great monolithic pillars of polished granite, polished by slaves, repolished by the moon, and rotating smoothly in the polished vacuum of the night, zoomed above us to support the mysterious rotundities of St. Isaac's Cathedral. We stopped on the brink, as it were, of these perilous massifs of stone and metal, and with linked hands, in Lilliputian awe, craned our heads to watch new colossal visions rise in our way. The 10 glossy gray atlantes of a palace portico, or a giant vase of porphyry near the iron gate of a garden, or that enormous column with a black angel on its summit that obsessed, rather than adorned, the moon-flooded palace square, and went up and up, trying in vain to reach the sub-base of Pushkin's Exegi Monumentum. She contended afterward, in her rare moments of moodiness, that our love had not withstood the strain of that winter. A flaw had appeared, she said. Through all those months I had kept writing verse to her, for her, about her, 2 or 3 poems per week. In the spring of 1916 I published a collection of them, and was horrified when she drew my attention to something I had not noticed at all when concocting the book. There it was, the same ominous flaw, the banal, hollow note, and glib suggestion that our love was doomed since it could never recapture the miracle of its initial moments, the rustle and rush of those limes in the rain, the compassion of the wild countryside. Moreover, but this neither of us saw at the time, my poems were juvenile stuff, quite devoid of merit and ought never to have been put on sale. The book, a copy of which still exists, alas, in the closed stacks of the Lenin Library, Moscow, deserved what it got at the tearing claws of the few critics who noticed it in obscure periodicals. My Russian literature teacher at school, Vladimir Hippius, a first-rate though somewhat esoteric poet whom I greatly admired, he surpassed in talent, I think, his much better-known cousin, Zinaida Hippius, woman poet and critic, brought a copy with him to class and provoked the delirious hilarity of the majority of my classmates by applying his fiery sarcasm, he was a fierce man with red hair, to my most romantic lines. His famous cousin at a session of the Literary Fund asked my father, its president, to tell me, please, that I would never, never be a writer. A well-meaning, needy, and talentless journalist, who had reasons to be grateful to my father, wrote an impossibly enthusiastic piece about me, some 500 lines dripping with fulsome praise. It was intercepted in time by my father, and I remember him and me, while we read it in manuscript, grinding our teeth and groaning, the ritual adopted by our family when faced by something in awful taste or by somebody's gaffe. The whole business cured me permanently of all interest in literary fame, and was probably the cause of that almost pathological and not always justified indifference to reviews, which in later years deprived me of the emotions most authors are said to experience. That spring of 1916 is the one I see as the very type of a St. Petersburg spring, when I recall such specific images as Tamara wearing an unfamiliar white hat among the spectators of a hard-fought interscholastic soccer game, in which that Sunday the most sparkling luck helped me to make save after save in goal. And a Camberwell beauty, exactly as old as our romance, sunning its bruised black wings, their borders now bleached by hibernation, on the back of a bench in Alexandrovsky Garden. And the booming of cathedral bells in the keen air, above the corrugated dark blue of the Neva, voluptuously free of ice. And the fair in the confetti-studded slush of the House Guard Boulevard during Katkin Week, with its squeaking and popping din, its wooden toys, its loud hawking of Turkish delight and Cartesian devils called Amerikanski Jiteli, American inhabitants. Minute goblins of glass riding up and down in glass tubes filled with pink or lilac-tinted alcohol, as real Americans do, though all the epithet meant was outlandish, in the shafts of transparent skyscrapers as the office lights go out in the greenish sky. The excitement in the streets made one drunk with desire for the woods and the fields. Tamara and I were especially eager to return to our old haunts. But all through April her mother kept wavering between renting the same cottage again and economically staying in town. Finally, under a certain condition, accepted by Tamara with the fortitude of Hans Andersen's Little Mermaid, the cottage was rented, and a glorious summer immediately enveloped us. And there she was, my happy Tamara, on the points of her toes, trying to pull down a racemosa branch in order to pick its puckered fruit. With all the world and its trees wheeling in the orb of her laughing eye, and a dark patch from her exertions in the sun forming under her raised arm in the raw shantung of her yellow frock. We lost ourselves in mossy woods, and bathed in a fairy tale cove, and swore eternal love by the crowns of flowers that, like all little Russian mermaids, she was so fond of weaving, and early in the fall she moved to town in search of a job. This was the condition set by her mother. And in the course of the following months, I did not see her at all. Engrossed as I was in the kind of varied experience which I thought an elegant littérateur should seek. I had already entered an extravagant phase of sentiment and sensuality that was to last about 10 years. In looking at it from my present tower, I see myself as 100 different young men at once, all pursuing one changeful girl in a series of simultaneous or overlapping love affairs, some delightful, some sordid, that ranged from one-night adventures to protracted involvements and dissimulations with very meager artistic results. Not only is the experience in question, and the shadow of all those charming ladies useless to me now in recomposing my past, but it creates a bothersome defocalization, and no matter how I worry the screws of memory, I cannot recall the way Tamara and I parted. There is possibly another reason, too, for this blurring. We had parted too many times before. During that last summer in the country, we used to part forever after each secret meeting, when in the fluid blackness of the night on that old wooden bridge between masked moon and misty river, I would kiss her warm, wet eyelids and rain-chilled face, and immediately after go back to her for yet another farewell, and then the long, dark, wobbly uphill ride, my slow, laboriously pedaling feet trying to press down the monstrously strong and resilient darkness that refused to stay under. I do remember, however, with heartbreaking vividness, a certain evening in the summer of 1917, when, after a winter of incomprehensible separation, I chanced to meet Tamara on a suburban train. For a few minutes between two stops in the vestibule of a rocking and rasping car, we stood next to each other. I in a state of intense embarrassment, of crushing regret, she consuming a bar of chocolate, methodically breaking off small, hard bits of the stuff, and talking of the office where she worked. On one side of the tracks, above bluish bogs, the dark smoke of burning peat was mingling with the smoldering wreck of a huge amber sunset. It can be proved, I think, by published records, that Alexander Bloch was even then noting in his diary the very peat smoke I saw and the wrecked sky. There was later a period in my life when I might have found this relevant to my last glimpse of Tamara as she turned on the steps to look back at me before descending into the jasmine-scented, cricket-mad dusk of a small station. But today, no alien marginalia can dim the purity of the pain. 3. When at the end of the year Lenin took over, the Bolsheviks immediately subordinated everything to the retention of power, and a regime of bloodshed, concentration camps, and hostages entered upon its stupendous career. At the time, many believed one could fight Lenin's gang and save the achievements of the March Revolution. My father, who had been elected to the Constituent Assembly, which in its preliminary phase strove to prevent the entrenchment of the Soviets, decided to remain as long as possible in St. Petersburg, but to send his large family to the Crimea, a region that was still free. This freedom was to last for only a few weeks longer. We traveled in two parties, my brother and I going separately from my mother and the three younger children. The Soviet era was a dull week old. Liberal newspapers still came out, and while seeing us off at the Nikolaevsky station and waiting with us, my imperturbable father settled down at a corner table in the buffet to write in his flowing, celestial hand, as the typesetters said, marveling at the absence of corrections, a leading article for the Moribund Wretch, or perhaps some emergency publication, on those special long strips of ruled paper, which correspond proportionally to columns of print. As far as I remember, the main reason for sending my brother and me off so promptly was the probability of our being inducted into the new Red Army if we stayed in town. I was annoyed at going to a fascinating region in mid-November, long after the collecting season was over, having never been very good at digging for pupae, though eventually I did turn up a few beneath a big oak in our Crimean garden. Annoyance changed to distress when, after making a precise little cross over the face of each of us, my father rather casually added that very possibly, Vesma возможно, he would never see us again, whereupon, in trench coat and khaki cap, With his briefcase under his arm, he strode away into the steamy fog. The long journey southward started tolerably well. With the heat still humming, and the lamps still intact in the Petrograd Simferopol first-class sleeper, and a passably famous singer in dramatic makeup, with a bouquet of chrysanthemums in brown paper pressed to her breast, stood in the corridor, tapping upon the pane, along which somebody walked and waved as the train started to glide, without one jolt to indicate we were leaving that gray city forever. But soon after Moscow, all comfort came to an end. At several points of our slow, dreary progression, the train, including our sleeping car, was invaded by more or less Bolshevized soldiers who were returning to their homes from the front. One called them either deserters or red heroes, depending upon one's political views. My brother and I thought it rather fun to lock ourselves up in our compartment and thwart every attempt to disturb us. Several soldiers traveling on the roof of the car added to the sport by trying to use, not unsuccessfully, the ventilator of our room as a toilet. My brother, who was a first-rate actor, managed to simulate all the symptoms of a bad case of typhus, and this helped us out when the door finally gave way. Early on the third morning, at a vague stop, I took advantage of a lull in those merry proceedings to get a breath of fresh air. I moved gingerly along the crowded corridor, stepping over the bodies of snoring men, and got off. A milky mist hung over the platform of an anonymous station. We were somewhere not far from Kharkov. I wore spats and a derby. The cane I carried, a collector's item that had belonged to my uncle Ruka, was of a light-colored, beautifully freckled wood, and the knob was a smooth pink globe of coral cupped in a gold coronet. Had I been one of the tragic bums who lurked in the midst of that station platform where a brittle young fop was pacing back and forth, I would not have withstood the temptation to destroy him. As I was about to board the train, it gave a jerk and started to move. My foot slipped, and my cane was sent flying under the wheels. I had no special affection for the thing. In fact, I carelessly lost it a few years later. But I was being watched, and the fire of adolescent amour propre prompted me to do what I cannot imagine my present self ever doing. I waited for 1, 2, 3, 4 cars to pass. Russian trains were notoriously slow in gaining momentum. And when at last the rails were revealed, I picked up my cane from between them and raced after the nightmarishly receding bumpers. A sturdy proletarian arm conformed to the rules of sentimental fiction, rather than to those of Marxism, by helping me to swarm up. Had I been left behind, those rules might still have held good, since I would have been brought near Tamara, who by that time had also moved south, and was living in a Ukrainian hamlet less than 100 miles from the scene of that ridiculous occurrence. 4. Of her whereabouts I learned unexpectedly a month or so after my arrival in southern Crimea. My family settled in the vicinity of Yalta, at Gaspra, near the village of Kores. The whole place seemed completely foreign. The smells were not Russian, the sounds were not Russian. The donkey braying every evening just as the muezzin started to chant from the village minaret, a slim blue tower silhouetted against the peach-colored sky, was positively Baghdadian. And there was I, standing on a chalky bridle path near a chalky stream bed where separate serpent-like bands of water thinly glided over oval stones. There was I, holding a letter from Tamara. I looked up at the abrupt Yaila Mountains, covered up to their rocky brows with the caracul of the dark, tauric pine, at the maquis-like stretch of evergreen vegetation between mountain and sea, at the translucent pink sky, where a self-conscious crescent shone with a single humid star near it. And the whole artificial scene struck me as something in a prettily illustrated, albeit sadly abridged, edition of the Arabian Nights. Suddenly I felt all the pangs of exile. There had been the case of Pushkin, of course. Pushkin, who had wandered in banishment here, among those naturalized cypresses and laurels. But though some prompting might have come from his elegies, I do not think my exaltation was a pose. Thenceforth, for several years, until the writing of a novel relieved me of that fertile emotion, the loss of my country was equated for me with the loss of my love. Meanwhile, the life of my family had completely changed. Except for a few jewels astutely buried in the normal filling of a talcum powder container, we were absolutely ruined. But this was a very minor matter. The local Tatar government had been swept away by a brand new Soviet, and we were subjected to the preposterous and humiliating sense of utter insecurity. During the winter of 1917-18, and well into the windy and bright Crimean spring, idiotic death toddled by our side. Every other day on the White Yalta Pier, where, as you remember, the lady of Chekhov's Lady with the Lapdog lost her lorgnette among the vacational crowd, various harmless people had in advance weights attached to their feet, and then were shot by tough Bolshevik sailors imported from Sebastopol for the purpose. My father, who was not harmless, had joined us by this time, after some dangerous adventures, and in that region of lung specialists had adopted the mimetic disguise of a doctor without changing his name, simple and elegant, as a chess annotator would have said of a corresponding move on the board. We dwelt in an inconspicuous villa that a kind friend, Countess Sofia Panin, had placed at our disposal. On certain nights, when rumors of nearing assassins were especially strong, the men of our family took turns patrolling the house. The slender shadows of oleander leaves would cautiously move in the sea breeze along a pale wall, as if pointing at something with a great show of stealth. We had a shotgun and a Belgian automatic, and did our best to pooh-pooh the decree which said that anyone unlawfully possessing firearms would be executed on the spot. Chance treated us kindly. Nothing happened beyond the shock we got in the middle of a January night, when a brigand-like figure, all swathed in leather and fur, crept into our midst. But it turned out to be only our former chauffeur, Tsiganov, who had thought nothing of riding all the way from St. Petersburg, on buffers and in freight cars, through the immense, frosty, and savage expanse of Russia, for the mere purpose of bringing us a very welcome sum of money, unexpectedly sent us by some good friends of ours. He also brought the mail received at our St. Petersburg address. Among it was that letter from Tamara. After a month's stay, Tsiganov declared the Crimean scenery bored him, and departed, to go all the way back north with a big bag over his shoulder, containing various articles which we would have gladly given him had we thought he coveted them, such as a trouser press, tennis shoes, nightshirts, an alarm clock, a flat iron, several other ridiculous things I have forgotten, and the absence of which only gradually came to light, if not pointed out with vindictive zeal by an anemic servant girl whose pale charms he had also rifled. Curiously enough, he had prevailed upon us to transfer my mother's precious stones from the talcum powder container that he had at once detected to a hole dug in the garden under a versatile oak. And there they all were after his departure. Then, one spring day in 1918, when the pink puffs of blossoming almond trees enlivened the dark mountainside, the Bolsheviks vanished, and a singularly silent army of Germans replaced them. Patriotic Russians were torn between the animal relief of escaping native executioners and the necessity of owing their reprieve to a foreign invader, especially to the Germans. The latter, however, were losing their war in the West and came to Yalta on tiptoe with diffident smiles, an army of gray apparitions easy for a patriot to ignore. And ignored it was, save for some rather ungrateful snickers at the half-hearted keep-off-the-grass signs that appeared on park lawns. A couple of months later, having nicely repaired the plumbing in various villas vacated by commissars, the Germans faded out in their turn. The whites trickled in from the east, and soon began fighting the Red Army, which was attacking the Crimea from the north. My father became Minister of Justice in the regional government located in Simferopol, and his family was lodged near Yalta on the Livadia grounds, the Tsar's former domain. A brash, hectic gaiety associated with white-held towns brought back, in a vulgarized version, the amenities of peaceful years. Cafés did a wonderful business. All kinds of theaters thrived. One morning on a mountain trail, I suddenly met a strange cavalier clad in a Circassian costume, with a tense, perspiring face painted a fantastic yellow. He kept furiously tugging at his horse, which, without heeding him, proceeded down the steep path at a curiously purposeful walk, like that of an offended person leaving a party. I had seen runaway horses, but I had never seen a walkaway one before, and my astonishment was given a still more pleasurable edge when I recognized the unfortunate rider as Morzhukhin, whom Tamara and I had so often admired on the screen. The film Haji Murad, after Tolstoy's tale of that gallant rough-riding mountain chief, was being rehearsed on the mountain pastures of the range. "Stop that brute!" "Dzhite prokletoe zhivotnoye," he said through his teeth as he saw me. But at the same moment, with a mighty sound of crunching and crashing stones, two authentic Tatars came running down to the rescue, and I trudged on with my butterfly net toward the upper crags where the Euxine race of the Hippolyte Grayling was expecting me. In that summer of 1918, a poor little oasis of miraged youth, my brother and I used to frequent the amiable and eccentric family who owned the coastal estate Oles. A bantering friendship soon developed between my coeval Lydia T. and me. Many young people were always around, brown-limbed, braceleted young beauties, a well-known painter called Sorin, actors, a male ballet dancer, merry white army officers, some of whom were to die quite soon, and what with beach parties, blanket parties, bonfires, a moon-spangled sea, and a fair supply of Crimean Muscat Lunel, a lot of amorous fun went on, and all the while against the frivolous, decadent, and somehow unreal background, which I was pleased to believe conjured up the atmosphere of Pushkin's visit to the Crimea a century earlier, Lydia and I played a little oasal game of our own invention. The idea consisted of paradising a biographic approach projected, as it were, into the future, and thus transforming the very specious present into a kind of paralyzed past as perceived by a doddering memoirist who recalls through a helpless haze his acquaintance with a great writer when both were young. For instance, either Lydia or I, it was a matter of chance inspiration, might say on the terrace after supper, "The writer liked to go out on the terrace after supper," or, "I shall always remember the remark V.V. made one warm night. It is," he remarked, "a warm night." Or, still sillier, "He was in the habit of lighting his cigarette before smoking it." All this delivered with much pensive, reminiscent fervor which seemed hilarious and harmless to us at the time. But now I catch myself wondering if we did not disturb unwittingly some perverse and spiteful demon. Through all those months, every time a bag of mail managed to get from the Ukraine to Yalta, there would be a letter to me from my Sinara. Nothing is more occult than the way letters, under the auspices of unimaginable carriers, circulate through the weird mess of civil wars. But whenever, owing to that mess, there was some break in our correspondence, Tamara would act as if she ranked deliveries with ordinary natural phenomena such as the weather or tides, which human affairs could not affect, and she would accuse me of not answering her, when in fact I did nothing but write to her and think of her during those months, despite my many betrayals. 5. Happy is the novelist who manages to preserve an actual love letter that he received when he was young within a work of fiction, embedded in it like a clean bullet in flabby flesh, and quite secure there among spurious lives. I wish I had kept the whole of our correspondence that way. Tamara's letters were a sustained conjuration of the rural landscape we knew so well. They were, in a sense, a distant but wonderfully clear antiphonal response to the much less expressive lyrics I had once dedicated to her. By means of unpampered words, whose secret I failed to discover, her high school girlish prose could evoke with plangent strength every whiff of damp leaf, every autumn-rusted frond of fern in the St. Petersburg countryside. "Why did we feel so cheerful when it rained?" she asked in one of her last letters, reverting, as it were, to the pure source of rhetorics. "Boje moi, mon Dieu, rather than my God, where has it gone, all that distant, bright, endearing? Vzioje to dalyokoi, svetloi, miloi." In Russia, no subject is needed here, since these are neuter adjectives that play the part of abstract nouns, on a bare stage, in a subdued light. Tamara, Russia, the wildwood grading into old gardens, my northern birches and firs. the sight of my mother getting down on her hands and knees to kiss the earth every time we came back to the country from town for the summer. Et la montagne, et le grand chêne. These are things that fate one day bundled up pell-mell and tossed into the sea, completely severing me from my boyhood. I wonder, however, whether there is really much to be said for more anesthetic destinies, for, let us say, a smooth, safe, small-town continuity of time, with its primitive absence of perspective, when at 50 one is still dwelling in the clapboard house of one's childhood, so that every time one cleans the attic one comes across the same pile of old brown schoolbooks, still together among later accumulations of dead objects, and where on summery Sunday mornings one's wife stops on the sidewalk to endure for a minute or two that terrible, garrulous, dyed, church-bound McGee woman, who, way back in 1915, used to be pretty, naughty Margaret Ann of the mint-flavored mouth and nimble fingers. The break in my own destiny affords me, in retrospect, a syncopal kick that I would not have missed for worlds. Ever since that exchange of letters with Tamara, homesickness has been with me a sensuous and particular matter. Nowadays, the mental image of matted grass on the Yala, of a canyon in the Urals or of salt flats in the Aral region, affects me nostalgically and patriotically as little or as much as, say, Utah. But give me anything on any continent resembling the St. Petersburg countryside, and my heart melts. What it would be actually to see again my former surroundings, I can hardly imagine. Sometimes I fancy myself revisiting them with a false passport under an assumed name. It could be done. But I do not think I shall ever do it. I have been dreaming of it too idly and too long. Similarly, during the latter half of my 16-month stay in the Crimea, I planned for so long a time to join Denikin's army, with the intention not so much of clattering astride a chamfrained charger into the cobbled outskirts of St. Petersburg, my poor Yuri's dream, as of reaching Tamara in her Ukrainian hamlet, that the army ceased to exist by the time I had made up my mind. In March of 1919, the Reds broke through in northern Crimea, and from various ports a tumultuous evacuation of anti-Bolshevik groups began. Over a glassy sea in the Bay of Sebastopol, under wild machine-gun fire from the shore, the Bolshevik troops had just taken the port, my family and I set out for Constantinople and Piraeus, on a small and shoddy Greek ship, Nadezhda, Hope, carrying a cargo of dried fruit. I remember trying to concentrate as we were zigzagging out of the bay on a game of chess with my father. One of the knights had lost its head, and a poker chip replaced a missing rook, and the sense of leaving Russia was totally eclipsed by the agonizing thought that, Reds or no Reds, letters from Tamara would be still coming, miraculously and needlessly, to southern Crimea, and would search there for a fugitive addressee, and weakly flap about like bewildered butterflies set loose in an alien zone at the wrong altitude among an unfamiliar flora. Chapter 13 1 In 1919, by way of the Crimea and Greece, a flock of Nabokovs, three families in fact, fled from Russia to Western Europe. It was arranged that my brother and I would go up to Cambridge, on a scholarship awarded more in atonement for political tribulations than in acknowledgement of intellectual merit. The rest of my family expected to stay for a while in London. Living expenses were to be paid by the handful of jewels which Natasha, a far-sighted old chambermaid just before my mother's departure from St. Petersburg in November 1917, had swept off a dresser into a necessaire, and which for a brief spell had undergone interment, or perhaps some kind of mysterious maturation, in a Crimean garden. We had left our northern home for what we thought would be a brief wait, a prudent perching pause on the southern ledge of Russia. But the fury of the new regime had refused to blow over. In Greece, during two spring months, braving the constant resentment of intolerant shepherd dogs, I searched in vain for Gruner's Orange Tip, Heldreich's Sulphur, Kreuper's White. I was in the wrong part of the country. On the Cunard liner Pannonia, which left Greece on May 18, 1919, 21 years too soon as far as I was concerned, for New York, but let us off at Marseille, I learned to foxtrot. France rattled by in the cold black night. The pale channel was still oscillating inside us when the Dover-London train quietly came to a stop. Repetitive pictures of gray pears on the grimy walls of Victoria Station advertised the bath soap English governesses had used upon me in my childhood. A week later, I was already shuffling cheek to cheek at a charity ball with my first English sweetheart, a wayward, willowy girl 5 years my senior. My father had visited London before, the last time in February 1916, when, with five other prominent representatives of the Russian press, he had been invited by the British government to take a look at England's war effort, which it was hinted did not meet with sufficient appreciation on the part of Russia's public opinion. On the way there, being challenged by my father and Kornay Chukovsky to rhyme on Africa, the poet and novelist Alexei Tolstoy, no relation to Count Lyov Nikolaevich, had supplied, though seasick, the charming couplet, Viju palmu I kafrika, yeto Afrika. I see a palm and a little kaffir. That's Africa. In England, the visitors had been shown the fleet. Dinners and speeches had followed in noble succession. The timely capture of Erzurum by the Russians, and the pending introduction of conscription in England, "Will you march to, or wait till march to," as the punning posters put it, had provided the speakers with easy topics. There had been an official banquet presided over by Sir Edward Grey, and a funny interview with George V, whom Tchaikovsky, the enfant terrible of the group, insisted on asking if he liked the works of Oscar Wilde. "The works of O. Wald." The king, who was baffled by his interpreter's accent, and who anyway had never been a voracious reader, neatly countered by inquiring how his guests liked the London fog. Later, Tchaikovsky used to cite this triumphantly as an example of British cant, tabooing a writer because of his morals. A recent visit to the public library in New York has revealed that the above incident does not appear in my father's book, Izvoyuyushche Angli, Petrograd, 1916, a report on England at war. And indeed, there are not many samples therein of his habitual humor beyond, perhaps, a description of a game of badminton, or was it fives, that he had with H.G. Wells, and an amusing account of a visit to some first-line trenches in Flanders, where hospitality went so far as to allow the explosion of a German grenade within a few feet of the visitors. Before publication in book form, this report appeared serially in a Russian daily. There, with a certain old-world naivete, my father had mentioned making a present of his Swan fountain pen to Admiral Jellicoe, who at a table had borrowed it to autograph a menu card, and had praised its fluent and suave nib. This unfortunate disclosure of the pen's make was promptly echoed in the London papers by a Maybe Todd and Company Limited advertisement, which quoted a translation of the passage and depicted my father handing the firm's product to the commander-in-chief of the Grand Fleet under the chaotic sky of a sea battle. But now there were no banquets, no speeches, and even no fives with Wells, whom it proved impossible to convince that Bolshevism was but an especially brutal and thorough form of barbaric oppression, in itself as old as the desert sands, and not at all the attractively new revolutionary experiment that so many foreign observers took it to be. After several expensive months in a rented house in Elm Park Gardens, my parents and the three younger children left London for Berlin, where, until his death in March 1922, my father joined Josef Hessen, a fellow member of the People's Freedom Party, in editing a Russian émigré newspaper, while my brother and I went to Cambridge, he to Christ College, I to Trinity. 2. I had two brothers, Sergei and Kirill. Kirill, the youngest child, 1911 to 1964, was also my godson, as happened in Russian families. At a certain stage of the baptismal ceremony in our Vera drawing-room, I held him gingerly before handing him to his godmother, Ekaterina Dmitrievna Danzas, my father's first cousin and a grandniece of Colonel K.K. Danzas, Pushkin's second in his fatal duel. In his childhood, Kirill belonged, with my two sisters, to the remote nurseries which were so distinctly separated from his elder brother's apartments in townhouse and manor. I saw very little of him during my 2 decades of European expatriation, 1919 to 1940, and nothing at all after that, until my next visit to Europe in 1960, when a brief period of very friendly and joyful meetings ensued. Kirill went to school in London, Berlin, and Prague, and to college at Louvain. He married Gilberte Barbasson, a Belgian girl, ran, humorously but not unsuccessfully, a travel agency in Brussels, and died of a heart attack in Munich. He loved seaside resorts and rich food. He loathed, as much as I do, bullfighting. He spoke 5 languages. He was a dedicated, practical joker. His one great reality in life was literature, especially Russian poetry. His own verse reflects the influence of Gumilyov and Hodasyevich. He published sparsely and was always as reticent about his writing as he was about his persiflage misted inner existence. For various reasons, I find it inordinately hard to speak about my other brother. That twisted quest for Sebastian Knight, 1940, with its gloriettes and self-mate combinations, is really nothing in comparison to the task I balked in the first version of this memoir, and am faced with now. Except for the 2 or 3 poor little adventures I have sketched in earlier chapters, his boyhood and mine seldom mingled. He is a mere shadow in the background of my richest and most detailed recollections. I was the coddled one, he the witness of coddling. Born caesareanly, 10.5 months after me, on March 12, 1900, he matured earlier than I, and physically looked older. We seldom played together. He was indifferent to most of the things I was fond of, toy trains, toy pistols, red Indians, red admirables. At 6 or 7 he developed a passionate adulation, condoned by Mademoiselle, for Napoleon, and took a little bronze bust of him to bed. As a child, I was rowdy, adventurous, and something of a bully. He was quiet and listless, and spent much more time with our mentors than I. At 10 began his interest in music, and thenceforth he took innumerable lessons, went to concerts with our father, and spent hours on end playing snatches of operas on an upstairs piano well within earshot. I would creep up behind and prod him in the ribs. A miserable memory. We attended different schools. He went to my father's former gymnasia, and wore the regulation black uniform to which, at 15, he added an illegal touch, mouse-gray spats. About that time, a page from his diary that I found on his desk and read, and in stupid wonder showed to my tutor, who promptly showed it to my father, abruptly provided a retroactive clarification of certain oddities of behavior on his part. The only game we both liked was tennis. We played a lot of it together, especially in England, on an erratic grass court in Kensington, on a good clay court in Cambridge. He was left-handed. He had a bad stammer that hampered discussions of doubtful points. Despite a weak service and an absence of any real backhand, he was not easy to beat, being the kind of player who never double faults and returns everything with the consistency of a banging wall. In Cambridge we saw more of each other than anywhere before, and had for once a few friends in common. We both graduated in the same subjects, with the same honors, after which he moved to Paris, where during the following years he gave lessons of English and Russian, just as I did in Berlin. We again met in the 1930s, and were on quite amiable terms in 1938 to 1940 in Paris. He often dropped in for a chat, Rue Boileau, where I lodged in 2 shabby rooms with you and our child, but it so happened he had been away for a while, that he learned of our departure to America only after we had left. My bleakest recollections are associated with Paris, and the relief of leaving it was overwhelming, but I am sorry he had to stutter his astonishment to an indifferent concierge. I know little of his life during the war. At one time he was employed as translator at an office in Berlin. A frank and fearless man, he criticized the regime in front of his colleagues, who denounced him. He was arrested, accused of being a British spy, and sent to a Hamburg concentration camp, where he died of inanition on January 10, 1945. It is one of those lives that hopelessly claim a belated something, compassion, understanding, no matter what, which the mere recognition of such a want can neither replace nor redeem. 3. The beginning of my first term in Cambridge was inauspicious. Late in the afternoon of a dull and damp October day, with a sense of indulging in some weird theatricals, I put on my newly acquired dark bluish academic gown and black square cap for my first formal visit to E. Harrison, my college tutor. I went up a flight of stairs and knocked on a massive door that stood slightly ajar. "Come in," said a distant voice with hollow abruptness. I crossed a waiting room of sorts and entered my tutor's study. The brown dusk had forestalled me. There was no light in the study, save for the glow of a large fireplace near which a dim figure sat in a dimmer chair. I advanced, saying, "My name is," and stepped into the tea-things that stood on the rug beside Mr. Harrison's low wicker armchair. With a grunt, he bent sideways from his seat to right the pot, and then scooped up and dumped back into it the wet black mess of tea-leaves it had disgorged. Thus the college period of my life began on a note of embarrassment, a note that was to recur rather persistently during my 3 years of residence. Mr. Harrison thought it a fine idea to have one white Russian lodge with another, and so at first I shared an apartment in Trinity Lane with a puzzled compatriot. After a few months he left college, and I remained sole occupant of those lodgings. They seemed intolerably squalid in comparison with my remote and by now non-existent home. Well do I remember the ornaments on the mantelpiece, a glass ashtray with the Trinity crest left by some former lodger, a seashell in which I found the imprisoned hum of one of my own seaside summers, and my landlady's old mechanical piano, a pathetic contraption full of ruptured, crushed, knotted music which one sampled once and no more. Narrow Trinity Lane was a staid and rather sad little street with almost no traffic, but with a long, lurid past beginning in the 16th century when it used to be Fine Silver Lane, although commonly called at the time by a coarser name because of the then abominable state of its gutters. I suffered a good deal from the cold, but it is quite untrue, as some have said it, that the polar temperature in Cambridge bedrooms caused the water to freeze solid in one's washstand jug. As a matter of fact, there would be hardly more than a thin layer of ice on the surface, and this was easily broken by means of one's toothbrush into tinkling bits, a sound which in retrospect has even a certain festive appeal to my Americanized ear. Otherwise, getting up was no fun at all. I still feel in my bones the bleakness of the morning walk up Trinity Lane to the baths, as one shuffled along, exuding pallid puffs of breath in a thin dressing gown over one's pajamas and with a cold, fat sponge bag under one's arm. Nothing in the world could induce me to wear next to my skin the woolies that kept Englishmen secretly warm. Overcoats were considered sissy. The usual attire of the average Cambridge undergraduate, whether athlete or leftist poet, struck a sturdy and dingy note. His shoes had thick rubber soles, his flannel trousers were dark gray, and the buttoned sweater called a jumper under his Norfolk jacket was a conservative brown. What I suppose might be termed the gay set wore old pumps, very light gray flannel trousers, a bright yellow jumper, and the coat part of a good suit. By that time my youthful preoccupation with clothes was on the wane, but it did seem rather a lark, after the formal fashions in Russia, to go about in slippers, eschew garters, and wear one's collar sewn onto one's shirt, a daring innovation in those days. The mild masquerade in which I indolently joined has left such trifling impressions upon my mind that it would be tedious to continue in this strain. The story of my college years in England is really the story of my trying to become a Russian writer. I had the feeling that Cambridge and all its famed features—venerable elms, blazoned windows, loquacious tower clocks—were of no consequence in themselves, but existed merely to frame and support my rich nostalgia. Emotionally, I was in the position of a man who, having just lost a fond kinswoman, realized, too late, that through some laziness of the routine-drugged human soul, he had neither troubled to know her as fully as she deserved, nor had shown her in full the marks of his not quite conscious then, but now unrelieved affection. As with smarting eyes I meditated by the fire in my Cambridge room, all the potent banality of embers, solitude, and distant chimes pressed against me, contorting the very folds of my face as an airman's face is disfigured by the fantastic speed of his flight. And I thought of all I had missed in my country, of the things I would not have omitted to note and treasure had I suspected before that my life was to veer in such a violent way. To some of the several fellow émigrés I met in Cambridge, the general trend of my feelings was so obvious and familiar a thing that it would have fallen flat and seemed almost improper if put into words. With the whiter of those white Russians, I soon found out that patriotism and politics boiled down to a snarling resentment which was directed more against Kerensky than against Lenin, and which proceeded solely from material discomforts and losses. Then, too, I ran into some quite unexpected difficulties with such of my English acquaintances as were considered to be cultured and subtle and humane, but who, for all their decency and refinement, would lapse into the most astonishing drivel when Russia was being discussed. I want to single out here a young socialist I knew, a lanky giant whose slow and multiple manipulations of a pipe were horribly aggravating when you did not agree with him and delightfully soothing when you did. With him I had many political wrangles, the bitterness of which invariably dissolved when we turned to the poets we both cherished. Today he is not unknown among his peers, which is, I readily admit, a pretty meaningless phrase. But then I am doing my best to obscure his identity. Let me refer to him by the name of Nesbitt, as I dubbed him, or affirm now having dubbed him, not only because of his alleged resemblance to early portraits of Maxim Gorky, a regional mediocrity of that era, one of whose first stories, My Fellow Traveler, another apt note, had been translated by a certain R. Nesbitt Bain, but also because Nesbitt has the advantages of entering into a voluptuous palindromic association with Ibsen, a name I shall have to evoke presently. It is probably true, as some have argued, that sympathy for Leninism on the part of English and American liberal opinion in the 20s was swung by consideration of home politics. But it was also due to simple misinformation. My friend knew little of Russia's past, and this little had come to him through polluted communist channels. When challenged to justify the bestial horror that had been sanctioned by Lenin, the torture house, the blood-bespattered wall, Nesbitt would tap the ashes out of his pipe against the fender knob, recross sinisterly his huge, heavily shod, dexterously crossed legs, and murmur something about the Allied blockade. He lumped together, as Tsarist elements, Russian émigrés of all hues, from peasant socialist to white general, much as today Soviet writers wield the term fascist. He never realized that had he and other foreign idealists been Russian in Russia, he and they would have been destroyed by Lenin's regime as naturally as rabbits are by ferrets and farmers. He maintained that the reason for what he demurely called less variety of opinion under the Bolsheviks than in the darkest Tsarist days was the want of any tradition of free speech in Russia, a statement he got, I believe, from the sort of fatuous Dawn in Russia stuff that eloquent English and American Leninists wrote in those years. But the thing that irritated me perhaps most was Nesbitt's attitude toward Lenin himself. All cultured and discriminating Russians knew that this astute politician had about as much taste and interest in aesthetic matters as an ordinary Russian bourgeois of the Flaubertian épicier sort, the type that admired Pushkin on the strength of Tchaikovsky's vile librettos, wept at the Italian opera, and was allured by any painting that told a story. But Nesbitt and his highbrow friends saw in him a kind of sensitive, poetic-minded patron and promoter of the newest trends in art, and would smile a superior smile when I tried to explain that the connection between advanced politics and advanced art was a purely verbal one, gleefully exploited by Soviet propaganda, and that the more radical a Russian was in politics, the more conservative he was on the artistic side. I had at my disposal a number of such truths that I liked to air, but that Nesbitt, firmly entrenched in his ignorance, regarded as mere fancy. The history of Russia, I might, for example, declare, could be considered from two points of views, both of which for some reason equally annoyed Nesbitt. First, as the evolution of the police, a curiously impersonal and detached force, sometimes working in a kind of void, sometimes helpless, and at other times outdoing the government in brutal persecution. And second, as the development of a marvelous